This is episode 511. If you're a parent, if your kid has autism, or if you have concerns about vaccine safety, then this episode is an absolute must. I sit down and speak with a medical doctor, pediatrician, father, and the author of a book on vaccines. And he is attempting to normalize conversations about vaccines and to simply make asking questions about your kid's health and safety, and yours, of course, not a political statement or a conspiracy. On this episode, we talk about a few big topics, which are the very underwhelming risk of disease if you don't vaccinate, the terrible standard of research trials that vaccines go through, the risks of having multiple doses in a single vial, particularly for babies, of course, how Big Pharma has controlled the social and cultural narrative around vaccines, and we also give you some tools to use when you go to the doctor so you can start making much more informed, healthier decisions and coming to that decision actually with your doctor. So, let's get into it.
Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Matty Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me, and now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good, by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin.
What's up, my healthy friends? So today we're entering into the space of hard conversations, despite the fact that this really shouldn't be social suicide to talk about. Meet Dr. Joel Warsh. He's just released a book that dares to do something rare, which is talk about vaccines without choosing a side. It's called Between a Shot and a Hard Place. He's a board-certified pediatrician, epidemiologist, and integrative health expert who believes a respectful dialogue is the way forward, not censorship or fear, which we've seen a lot of in the last few years. So put your fists away and open your mind. And Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. That was a great intro. I love that. Yeah, I'm not about fighting. I wish we could just discuss things more.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're here to do that. And I'm curious, given the last few years and COVID, and I mean, even before that, it was super controversial to talk about, or if you ever suggested that there was a consequence to vaccines, you know, was socially shunned. So what gave you the courage to talk about it, especially as a medical professional?
Yeah, I mean, originally I didn't, you know, I think that for me, I guess if I'm going back a little bit, so I did all the regular medical training. I trained a Great Western program in Los Angeles, but I, at that time, met my wife, who's holistic minded, opened up my eyes to a little bit of a different viewpoint. And then as I was in practice, started to learn about integrative medicine and really never went back from there. And when you're in that integrative space, you start getting a lot of questions about vaccines from parents. And these are not things that I ever really thought about. I mean, when you're going through med school, you're kind of taught, here are the vaccines, here are the horrible diseases. These vaccines are the best thing ever. We have these horrible diseases before. We don't have them anymore. So here's your schedule. Go do it. And that's all you really think. You don't think to question it. You don't really look anything up on your own. And there's not a lot more discussion than that. So that's kind of how I went into practice, right? It's like, oh, yeah, vaccines, great. And as you're going through, people start to have questions, they start to have stories, you start to learn a lot more. And it really did open up my eyes to another world. And I had to start learning and researching a lot more about vaccines just because I was getting so many questions. And then over the last decade, I really noticed that things were getting more and more censored. I mean, they were always censored, but it was certainly much worse over the last few years. And it really wasn't something you could talk about openly, which was unfortunate. You could, you know, I talked about it in the office, but online, if anybody mentioned anything, like you said, you just get your platform shut down. So it just wasn't something that was done, I think, very frequently. But I just got really frustrated over COVID. I felt that it was something I needed to do. I had been researching and looking into vaccines so much for my practice and then really wanted to write a book. And so that's why I did that. And really, to me, it was, if I'm going to talk about this, I have to be as educated as possible. And I also, when people start asking questions about vaccines, they're like, well, what should I read? What should I look at? And it was like, well, you got to read multiple things because everyone is so biased. And every book you read is like on very one side. And so I really wanted to do my best to try to do something that's, you know, somewhat in the middle and talk about both sides, if there are sides, and really what information is out there and what information we we can get to. And ultimately, the goal was not to get people to do or not do anything. It's just to have discussions. Like, I think we should be able to have a talk like this, talk about vaccines. We could have different opinions. That's fine. But ultimately, we should be able to discuss it. And that way we can move forward to get the science that we need to get for the questions that people have that we don't actually have yet. And I think that should be okay. But it just hasn't been, or at least wasn't. It's better now. I mean, I think people are much more open to talking about it. It's been surprising for me to see how open people have been and interested to talk about the last 6 months or so. But that wasn't what I expected.
Yeah, it feels like when somebody in the room is confident enough to talk about it, everybody else breathes a sigh of relief, like, oh, finally we could talk about this. But you just need that first person that's like not afraid of the consequences to bring it up.
Yeah, I think so. And there certainly were people that did, but a lot of them did lose their platforms. I mean, I wasn't confident enough to do that 5-10 years ago, and I didn't feel it was the right place for me. I mean, obviously I could talk about vaccines, but I think you need to be really educated. You have to go through the research. You have to look at it yourself, because ultimately, you know, for sure for me, I realized like there's very little that I knew from my training when it comes to vaccines. We assume a lot, but a lot of what you're taught isn't actually necessarily true, or not necessarily what the research actually shows. Or there are a lot of questions that people have that are reasonable questions that we should be able to discuss. And for whatever reason, medicine is so definitive with their statements around vaccines, and there's no room for discussion or a potential problem or anything like that, it seems like, over the last few years. And that's just not the reality of a medical product. Like, everything has risks, and we should be able to talk about that, and we should be able to figure out how do we make a product better. But that's not the angle of conversation. It certainly wasn't the pandemic. It was safe and effective. These are the best things ever. They never cause a problem. And you're like, well, but they're new. Like, how do we know that they don't cause a problem? How do we know they don't cause a problem 5 years from now? Like, we don't know those things. And so there's a clear lack of honesty that's going on. And I think that's very pervasive in the vaccine research.
Yeah, I was one of those people that lost the platform during COVID. and I formerly worked in hospitals as well. And it was during COVID that I made the choice to leave, because I just felt that I could not work for an organization. Like, my professor literally sat me down, and I was very, very much, rebelling, I guess. Or not even rebelling, standing up for what I believed in, which to everybody would have looked like rebelling. And my professor even pulled me aside, was like, Maddie, I'm with you. I'm all on board, but we've got to keep everybody in a job. And I literally quit on the spot, because I basically said, if I am working for someone in an organization that's willing to put politics and the law before, you know, human health, and this is meant to be a hospital, then, you know, what else have you lied about? What else have you covered up because you've got to keep people in a job, or whatever the narrative is? And so I left. Unfortunately, this podcast was doing very well, so I was able to, you know, financially not be too scared of what was going to happen without a job. But I also got deplatformed, my Instagram, thousands of followers deleted. So, but the multiple year break from Instagram was probably healthy for my brain. But you mentioned medical school in there. Like, what is the sort of, I guess, education for a doctor going through medical school on vaccines? Is it just that they're good? Is it 1 hour? Is it, you know, 10 hours? Like, how much do people actually get?
I think it's hard to quantify, because, I mean, you certainly talk about vaccines, but it's not discussing the background on vaccines or safety around vaccines. It's more around the diseases and the efficacy and the schedule. So it's very minimal. I mean, I don't recall that much training at all. I mean, not in medical school at all, really, but other than learning about the diseases. But in pediatrics training, I mean, we definitely learn about the vaccines. We learn about the schedule. We learn some basic facts about why things were the way they are, but very, very minimal. So it's almost nothing. You certainly don't look at the safety research. You certainly don't learn about why you shouldn't trust pharma, right? Like, that's the kind of stuff you should be taught, right? Like, you should be like, why don't you just blindly trust pharma 101? Like, that would be a good thing to teach doctors. Like, hey, maybe these companies that could make billions of dollars might not do everything in our best interest. Doesn't mean that we should trust them. Doesn't mean that there aren't amazing pharmaceuticals. Of course there are. We're very lucky that we have these things. But, you know, maybe they're not always that honest, or maybe they do things in a way to kind of massage the research to their benefit. None of that is explained to any doctor. So they're just kind of taught, like, all right, here's the research. Here's what we said. Let's go do it. Here's the CDC schedule, you know, the schedule in your country. Go do that. That's what we're taught. And you don't think to question it, because you're like, why would they tell me anything wrong? Like, why would there be a problem with vaccines? These are the best things ever. Like, that's kind of the way that you think. You just don't really question. It's not nefarious. I think sometimes people think, doctors do things in a nefarious way, like, oh, they're ignoring, like, most people just don't know. Like, I don't think most people know the research on vaccines. They just think they do.
Yeah, one of the things that I ended up sort of much more naturally health-oriented, or integrative, if you like, because of my experience in the cancer hospital. So that's the biggest part of my career, is working in cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, and being privy to a lot of conversations with pharmaceutical companies and asking for funding and presenting research. And I saw enough and heard enough things to begin being skeptical. I didn't grow up in a hippie, you know, woo-woo family or anything like that. It was just, I was young, probably overtly confident and to my benefit and or not. But that was just the beginning of me asking some questions like, oh, like, why don't we, you know, help people with other things? Like in Australia, the Cancer Council website, I remember when I first got that job, I went to the Cancer Council website and the first sentence on the About Cancer page was 90 to 95% of cancer is diet and lifestyle. And I literally, again, went to my professor and I said, why isn't this place about diet and lifestyle? And he just kind of laughed at me. I guess to extend that kind of, you know, conversation to vaccines, it seems like vaccines are the only medication which you're not allowed to talk about have any side effects. They're meant to be these magical, mystical things that are just perfect for humanity, but all the other drugs, it's totally normal to have side effects. And you hear the advertisements, which have, you know, a 1 minute ad for in the US particularly for the drug, and then a 4 minute disclaimer because of all of the side effects. Why do you think we've got this culture or this culture has been produced where vaccines are mythical, magical things that save us from, and all the other drugs are, you know, it's normal for them to have side effects?
I think that that has to be a product of pharma. I mean, they have so much money, they've gotten so big, and I think they have shaped the narrative around that. I think that they have so much money. They funded the journals, they funded the doctors, they funded the medical schools, they funded the programs, they funded the news. They have their tentacles in everything. And I think that it's not necessarily nefarious. It's just really good marketing. Like, they're just really good at making everybody not even realize that they're doing it. And their job is to sell more products. And especially when it comes to America, you know, we can't sue vaccine manufacturers. Like, that's against the law here. And basically, if you do have a reaction, you sue the government, and then there's a special fund that maybe you can get some money from, but you don't sue the government, you don't sue the company, which is the way that every other thing is. So the manufacturers don't have incentive like anybody else would with any other product to make them better or make them safer. They have all the incentive to get it on the market, to get it on the schedule, because then a lot of people do it, and they have all the organizations and doctors kind of behind them saying it's the best thing ever. They don't have to do anything else. So they don't have the push really to make it safer or better. They just have a push to get it on the market. And that's a very unique thing with vaccines. And again, I don't think it's nefarious. I just think this is the environment that's come about over the last 50 years, because you have these wildly profitable products for these companies that they don't have to worry about safety, not really, because they're not getting sued for it. So, I mean, obviously they don't want like a super unsafe drug, but when it comes to vaccines, their most reactions are like, ah, it's just coincidence. And so it's really hard to know what actually does occur from a vaccine or not. And I think that's a big problem with the vaccine world, is that we don't exactly know how safe they are.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was you know, in preparation for our conversation, just looking around the internet, who's doing what, who's talking about what on YouTube with this conversation. I think it was the Dr. Mike, who's got a massive following on YouTube. He sat down with like 20 anti-vaxxers and what blew my mind is that he talked a lot about coincidence. And it's like, as a health professional or as just a logical human being, when somebody presents with something, the first thing you do is build a timeline of like what happened, what triggered it, what happened like after that or before that, what did you eat or what did you do, what was the situation? And it's like, in any situation, a medical professional would usually ask a few questions about the timeline of events that happened around said reaction. And he just kept talking about like, oh, it's a coincidence and that these things happen, and we can't rule that out. And I agree, we can't rule that out. But it was just wild how it's like we apply this like one abstract thinking to this situation, and to not be open to the idea that, well, a medication that's got heavy metals and a range of other things in it has just gone into the human body And the idea that there might never be a reaction to that, it's wild to me.
Right, right. And that's like the exact way that I think about it too, because yes, like coincidence does happen and it could be a coincidence. And it is true, you could get a vaccine this morning and die this afternoon of a heart attack, and it could have nothing to do with that vaccine, and you would have had a heart attack anyways. But if a lot of people are having heart attacks the afternoon after they have a vaccine, yes, you should probably look into it, right? And it's like, that is the basis of science. Coincidence does not mean causation, but you start to notice a pattern. And when you notice a pattern, then you take note of that pattern, and then you start to study it, and then you get the best kind of studies possible, you know, prospective trials and things like that, to look at the things that people are saying over and over again. And we have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people saying the same thing, you know, whether it's autism, long-term complications, heart issues, you know, after COVID vaccine, like all these things that were just coincidences. And it's like, okay, maybe some of it is. I'm not saying that it's not, but you can't call these people woo. These are literally people that went to get a vaccine that think that the vaccine caused their issue. Now, they could be wrong. That's what the research is for. But to just brush that off as a coincidence, to me, is so disheartening. And it's so counterintuitive to everything else that we've ever done. And in medicine, it's like, okay, you give a kid, you know, it's traditionally, give them amoxicillin for, I don't know, an ear infection, and they get some hives or a rash. And you're like, oh, they're probably allergic to amoxicillin, even if it might have just been from the virus. Let's never give them amoxicillin again in their life. You give a kid a vaccine, they have a seizure a day later, and you're like, oh, it's a coincidence, right? It's the things just don't add up. It's like, look, we don't have to say that vaccines cause all sorts of problems all the time, but to assume that they never cause a problem, that's ridiculous. To assume that it's one in a million doesn't make any sense to me. We haven't looked for a lot of the long-term complications, so we don't exactly know how common that might be. And we're just assuming that they're just always safe and effective, which just can't be the case. Like, you're injecting a bunch of stuff into kids. Some kids with some genetics in certain situations are going to have a reaction sometime. That's not woo-woo. I mean, we've documented that they've had seizures and Guillain-Barré syndrome, encephalitis. So we know these things can occur for sure. So why couldn't some of the other things also occur sometimes? And if each one of these things is one in a million, but you add up all those things and you're getting 30 plus vaccines, well, that number starts to get smaller really quickly. It starts to go from one in a million to one in 10,000 or one in 1,000 pretty quickly when you start to have a lot of vaccines with a lot of different potential issues that are rare. So those are the kind of things that we have to be able to look into, research and study, because you have to say, well, if we have some of these diseases that aren't really around anymore, then do we need to keep giving that vaccine? Or what is the risk-benefit ratio? Does this kid need it? Or should we make a safer vaccine because the risks are too high for the benefits? Like, these are the questions that are science that we should be able to ask. Not to say we should never vaccinate, but maybe there are certain ones that we don't have to do anymore. Or maybe there are ones that we don't have to do as much of. Like, we don't just give everybody a smallpox vaccine anymore just because we have the vaccine. Like, we haven't had smallpox, so we don't do it. How many diphtheria cases are there? How many polio cases are there? There are a lot of things we just don't see very much of anymore. So maybe we don't need to give kids five of those.
The argument, though, from most people, which I know you understand already, is usually we need to keep vaccinating because otherwise all of those terrible things will come back.
Right. And that is not an unreasonable thought, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that a two-month-old needs to get some of these things if there hasn't been a case in 40 years. Like, maybe you can give a kid one vaccine when they're 10 instead of four vaccines in the first year for polio. Like, I don't know the answer to that. I'm just saying these are the things we could talk about. These are things that should be reasonable discussions. Obviously, we don't want polio to come back and everybody get polio, but you may not need to give these all to newborn babies when there hasn't been cases in a long time, especially as we start to add more and more vaccines. I think it's not unreasonable to look at cumulative effect and to start saying, well, maybe there are too many. Maybe we're getting to a point where we shouldn't just keep adding more. Maybe we got to prioritize the most important ones. Or even from a safety perspective, let's just say they are totally safe, but maybe there's just too many. It's overwhelming people, which is the case. Like, a lot of parents are just very concerned that there's just too many. They're going to go in too frequently. They're going to poke their kids too many times. So maybe we just need to prioritize which ones are the most important. And the other ones can just be more of a recommendation. The other ones are like, well, we really think you should get your measles shot. That's the one you should prioritize. Like, we're not hearing any sort of discussion. And again, I'm not saying what the right answer is. It's just we should be able to have these discussions because it's not woo-woo. It's not crazy. And we're talking about the most benefit for the least risk. And if you can't talk about the risk and you can't talk about the benefit and you can't weigh the pros versus the cons and you can't have an educated discussion about what's best for our kids, it's just more, more, more. And that doesn't work for me as someone who tries to think these things through, that like, you can't just do a million vaccines. Like, there has to be a point where it's too many.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I've got so many things I want to talk about, but I was just thinking too, historically speaking, you know, to get to this place where we're unquestioning and we're so willing to get more and more vaccines. It has a long history in both England and the USA, you know, of being very heavily regimented and enforced by the police. And there was lots of laws through the 1700s, 1800s about, you know, the compulsory vaccination, despite an uprising and a rebellion which recurred many times. And we've got a 6-month-old baby at the moment. And so we're around lots of new parents and, you know, parents just literally like can't wait to get them all into their kid. And this is not their fault. Like they don't know the risks, or that they all in the mix of identity politics are like, I'm not one of those crazy hippies that thinks that stuff. And they're like, oh, why can't we just get them all on the same day? And they're asking these questions and it's like, oh, these poor kids, like these little babies' nervous systems and biology that's just being, you know, infiltrated with such massive amounts of stuff, which might not be helpful.
Yeah, well, I think that is the question, right? Like you should be able to talk about that rationally and say, oh, look, there are certainly some potential benefits from vaccines, right? And we certainly don't want kids to get sick from measles and die, or Haemophilus and die. Like, we don't want that. But you're also doing a bunch of stuff to a child. You're poking them, you're injecting them. There's a lot of things in vaccines. It's not just an antigen. There are metals. Yes, it's a small amount, but that's just, you know, oh, it's just a small amount. It's okay. It never causes an issue. And you're like, but, you know, someone can walk by a peanut and have a whiff and get anaphylaxis. Like, everybody's different. Everyone's genetics are different. And maybe for certain kids, that little amount of metal is too much. Or maybe whatever other thing in the vaccine you have an allergic reaction to or have a reaction to. Like, these are all the things that we have to consider when we're talking about our kid. And as we add more and more, it needs to be okay to have discussions about risk versus benefits. How many is too many? What's the right amount? What's the individual risk? Do you really need these things? How much do you need them? Which ones are better? Like, these are all the questions we have to discuss, as opposed to just do it because we said so. And like you said, most people don't realize what your risks are for most of these diseases, and your risks for most of these diseases are almost zero. Like, it's very, 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 very low for the majority of these diseases. A lot of them are not around anymore, or even if they are around and you get it, your risk is really, really small of having a serious disease. Most of the time, it's a mild cold for a lot of these diseases. Now, could you get very sick? Sure, you could. Do people die from the flu? Absolutely. Could you die from measles? You could. But most people don't. So I think you just need to understand those risks, because it doesn't mean you want to have a risk for measles and you want to take that risk. You might not. You might want your measles shot, and that basically decreases your risk from that disease to zero. But maybe you have a very sensitive kid who has a lot of reactions to everything, and maybe that's not the kid that needs 15 vaccines. Maybe you can prioritize, or maybe that kid doesn't get any vaccines. That's the one you're protecting. Like, that's what we're supposed to be talking about. We're supposed to be talking about protecting each kid. I don't want kids to get sick. I want them to be healthier. And just by doing more vaccines is not necessarily always the answer.
I've got a question that, just out of curiosity, what your thoughts are on my thinking here. Like, over the last 100 years, you know, commercialization of basically every industry has occurred. And with that, well, what has driven that in many ways is convenience and, like, how fast can we get to a result? You know, and I'm sure that Uber or Amazon's next step is to actually feed you the food.
Probably. Or into your brain.
Yeah, totally. And so I'm wondering too, if, like, once upon a time, resilience and hardship was just an expected part of life and very much a rite of passage. And I'm wondering if either the modern pharma narrative or the convenience culture has produced a Western culture, or maybe a global culture, of people that are totally fearful of or doing everything to avoid illness and sickness and the measles and the flu and these kinds of things. Even, and sure, again, we don't want anyone to die from those things, but there's benefit to going through them for the immune system. There's, you know, we know that back in the day they used to have parties where you would go and everybody would catch chickenpox to ensure that they never got it again. You know? And so I'm wondering if this idea of, like, do everything you can to avoid my kid getting sick is driving this, oh, actually, might be better for them to catch some of these things so that their immune system can be trained and develop in a way that means that they're healthier later on, or they've built some immunological resilience. And so convenience cultures may be like, oh, we've got vaccines, just avoid all of the problems.
Yeah, I think that's a very good nuanced question that is it's difficult to answer, because I think there's a lot of parts to that. But from the way that I think about it is, I mean, if you go back in time, I think we're much more afraid of disease than we should be now, because of the historical context. I mean, if you go back even in the early 1900s, the death rate from a lot of diseases was extremely high. And I believe that we have this false memory through culture of the fact that vaccines saved us all and got rid of all these diseases, which isn't true, right? I mean, most of these diseases, the death rate was near zero before the vaccines ever hit the market. So the reality of a lot of these conditions, like let's say measles, even for our great, like our great great grandparents, it was a huge deal. Like if you got measles, there's a good chance you might die back then, right? I mean, not a huge chance, but like you were worried about it, or if you had the flu back then. And then you see where the disease rates went, and they were plummeting before the vaccines came out. It was really that we're better at nutrition. We have better sanitation. We understand what diseases are. We don't have horses pooping in the street. We have antibiotics, like all these things that can actually help save your life. So there was still a lot of disease around. Like there was still a lot of cases of measles, but it was very mild around the time when the vaccine came out, to the point where there were maybe even just 300 to 400 deaths from measles per year before the vaccine ever came out. And there's still tens of thousands from the flu. So you can see the relative concern level there. Like the concern around measles is not really proportional to the death rate. And that's, you know, 50 years ago now. So we, I think, are so afraid of a lot of these diseases, which would cause illness, but not necessarily severe illness for most people. Now, could it? Yes, it could, but I think we're in a much better place in society in general to handle these diseases. And I do think, yeah, I think we're used to convenience. We also, I think social media makes it much tougher because you see the very worst case scenario. So it's really easy to see the one kid in Australia or in Europe that gets measles and die. And you're like, oh, this is the worst thing ever. We could have prevented this. But when in the reality, it's one kid out of the millions that gets it. And then you have to, if you have a scientific mindset back, say, okay, we don't want that one kid to die. But if the measles vaccine is causing 1,000 deaths, well, it's a trade-off there, right? So you have to weigh that, and you have to say, okay, so is the measles vaccine benefiting you more than the deaths? And that's the weight calculations that you have to make. And then you have to take into account, okay, like pneumonia and other serious complications. And you have to think about that holistically. Why it's so complicated. It's not a simple question, but I do think, yes, we're so used to convenience, we're so used to simplicity, and we're so used to like, well, we have these things, so like let's just stomp out these 10 diseases, even though there's so many other things you can catch. But ultimately, I think we've moved so far to putting vaccines as a religion that we're forgetting that they're just a medical product. And ultimately, for each one, you have to weigh the potential benefit from that protection of that disease against potential risks you take from that vaccine. And you mentioned another great point, which is never really talked about or very rarely talked about, but like, what are the benefits from actually getting a disease? So yes, you have to survive the disease, right? But if you do, then you have better immunity. So we know that's for sure true. And then does that disease have any sort of long-term benefits to your immune system or other things? I mean, that's complicated and controversial, but I think it's a reasonable question. I think that's a way that we've evolved. So I think there probably are some potential benefits to some of these diseases for sure, assuming you don't, die from it.
Yeah, the goal is always to not die.
Yeah, exactly. But people say that they're like, oh, there's so many benefits from measles. And you're like, yes, but that's assuming you didn't die, right? So you have to like, you have to weigh those two things because yes, you have better immunity, but the theoretical point of a vaccine would be you're giving somebody you're giving your immune system a knowledge of the disease, so that way you don't get super sick when you get it. So like that's the literal point of a vaccine, is to not get really, really sick if it works well. But if you don't give a vaccine, then you still have the potential of getting really sick from the disease. So you have to weigh those two things.
Because you're listening here, I can safely assume you're an absolute legend. And so if you want to keep this party going, I'd love to invite you over to follow me on Instagram or YouTube, both under the same name of The Real Weight Loss Coach. Over there, you'll find different content in both places. It's different. So heaps of bite-sized pieces of information. So if you want to learn lots of things really fast with a bit of a scroll, or simply you just prefer some visuals, then scroll over to The Real Weight Loss Coach on Instagram and YouTube. So see you there. Thank you. And let's get back into the episode. Totally. And well, and then the other thing as part of weighing those things is like with improved sanitization, sterilization, nutrition, and all of those things, am I more likely to weather the storm, than die?
Right. And you are. I mean, you were more likely to weather the storm and die back then. But for sure now you are. I mean, you can run through any disease and there's very little death from any of these diseases combined that we vaccinate for. So it's just, maybe a few thousand deaths total of all the diseases, other than take out flu, for all the kid vaccines. Right. And the cases are really low right now. So even if you didn't vaccinate at all, almost all these diseases have very few cases, maybe just a couple thousand every year. So your chance of even getting them, you know, maybe other than whooping cough, are extremely low, but not zero. It's still possible. And then there's a public health aspect to it, because for some of the vaccines, they do stop transmission. So if everybody stops vaccinating, then it will probably come back and there'll be more cases. So you are weighing those two things. But yes, currently for most of these diseases, you're never going to see it whether you vaccinate or not.
I'm curious as well, like, I guess the conversation comes up where we're talking about, you mentioned it sort of like a religion, the religion of scientism. And it's almost like now we don't even debate around death and outcomes. It's just like whether you got it or not, whether you're a believer or you're an anti-vaxxer. You know, it's like we're not even talking about, yeah, the consequences of the things we're talking, consequences of the vaccines or the benefits of the vaccines per se. It's just you're in this camp or you're in this camp. But what was the thing that you mentioned at the start, your partner is holistically minded. But did you see in working with children and working with people, did you see people having vaccine reactions or injuries? Is that what led you really down this path to write a book?
I don't think it's seeing the injuries. I think it's talking to parents. So I wouldn't say that I've seen a ton of horrible injuries. I mean, I've certainly seen the more minor things. And I've certainly had parents come to me that swear that's happened to them. And just being in this space, I've had so many people reach out to me. So I think it's just watching with my own eyes, with my own, listening with my own ears, hearing how many stories there are, how many people have similar concerns, even during COVID, how many doctors had issues with the COVID vaccine and how many had their own problems. And it's like, you're just sitting there. And I'm like, well, if this many people are having issues, how many more are there? Right. And how many things are not going reported, and what is the real scope of the problem? And you're talking about, let's say with the COVID vaccine, like doctors that had liver issues or heart issues or, you know, died suddenly, maybe it wasn't from the COVID vaccine, but like enough things that they themselves described as a problem that they had with the vaccine. And they're like, but everybody should go get it. And you're like, do you not see this in the small chat group? Like 10 people had a problem. So like how many more people are having it? And it's not to say that you shouldn't ever do it, but I think there's this like really large mismatch between the reality of what's going on and what I'm seeing with my own eyes and the way that we talk about it. And that led me to want to talk about it, because if I'm going to be asked all these questions, I don't feel like I could answer these questions unless I had done the research myself, because most of the research I didn't know, and I didn't feel confident enough to do it, because it's quite a big thing to say when you're going to go and you're going to say, well, I don't think they've been studied long term like they should be, or I don't think the research on vaccines and autism is definitive like we say it. Like, you have to know that. You have to be sure. And even when I was going through, I was like, that can't be it. Like, you know, you go through some things, you're like, that can't be true. And it is. Like, okay, for example, Hep B. You would think that hepatitis B vaccine that we give to newborns on day one of life would have such extensive research and such impressive safety testing. And in the package insert, it's studied for 5 days and 147 kids. That's the safety testing for the hepatitis B vaccine that's in the package insert. And you're like, that can't be it. There's no way that that's what it was approved based upon. And it was. Like, there's been Freedom of Information Act petitions trying to get more information, and nothing that I've seen, no books, no, you know, government resources, nothing has shown that it was approved based on more than that. So you start to see things like that, and you're like, what? Like, that's something we're giving to every newborn, and we're saying that it's so safe based on that? Like, that, I'm not saying it's unsafe. I'm saying that's not good enough. Like, we have to do more testing to make sure if you're giving something to a newborn baby that it's not causing problems down the line, especially for something that they probably aren't going to get when they're a newborn baby anyways. So we need to have higher safety standards, I think.
Oh, I totally agree. I have this debate with some of our friends quite regularly on the way that the testing is done of vaccines. And so often the thing that the new vaccine is compared against is really just the last vaccine. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, sort of, you know, get into this conversation of, I'm often like, there's not enough placebo-controlled trials, and everyone says there is. And it's like, no, there's a very important distinction, because placebo and placebo-like, there's a very important distinction there, because placebo-like is not placebo and is often actually another drug.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a trick that's been played by the pharma company, because the definition of placebo is an inert substance, right? I mean, you know that. And it's something that, you know, salt water, saline, something that's not supposed to do anything in your body. And so the way that almost all these trials have been conducted for the regular scheduled vaccines, especially the original ones, they used a placebo, but the placebo was not inert. So it's not really a placebo. It's just, they call it a placebo so they could say, yeah, it was placebo controlled tested. So it was, if someone in pharma was like, oh, we placebo control tested it. Well, that's true. They did, but they didn't use an actual placebo. They just called it a placebo. So that's the reality of what a lot of that research is. And it gives you a relative safety, but not absolute safety. And so we're left with this weird circular thinking when it comes to vaccines. And like a great example that I talk about often is the whooping cough vaccine, right? Because, you know, the new one, the DTaP acellular pertussis, was tested against the old one, DTP whole cell pertussis. And the old one was taken off the market for safety issues, right? For concerns around encephalitis and seizures. And so you're saying, well, we have this new one on the market that's safe, but it's only relatively safe. Maybe it was a little safer, but does that mean that the new one is safe? And it doesn't mean that it isn't safe, but it's not the best kind of testing that we should have. And to just give an example for someone that maybe not familiar with this kind of research. So if you're doing a study and you're going vaccine A versus vaccine B, and both groups, they have 10 seizures. That's the way that it's done right now. You have this placebo that's a different vaccine or a mixture of something minus the antigen. And they say, oh, yeah, well, they both had 10 seizures. So that's equal. No more seizures. That's safe. And that's their study. Versus if they did it the best possible way, vaccine one versus vaccine two versus a placebo, and it was 10, 10, and one seizure, that's a very different study. And then you're saying, well, maybe both vaccines are not safe, right? And they don't have to do that. So we don't have that kind of research for a lot of these vaccines. And anybody that says that they do is lying, because they're just making that up. Like, it's not true. We don't have those studies for safety for the kid vaccines on the market. There are placebo-controlled trials on some of the vaccines that are not commonly used. Some of them have done post-licensure, but nothing really before. And so it's really frustrating when you actually see that, because we need to demand more. When we're going forward, if you're going to put a new vaccine on the market, like, they have to do safety testing like that. You would have assumed it would have been done in the first place. You would assume a hepatitis B vaccine given to a newborn baby would have been studied hundreds of thousands of kids against a saline placebo, followed for 5 or 10 years before you're giving it to a newborn baby. That's what I thought the research would show. They studied 147 kids for 5 days for safety. How was that good enough? Like, that's not anti-vaccine or anti-science. That's like, I don't want to give my newborn a shot unless it's been studied to actually be safe and protect them long term.
Well, I would actually argue that it's very pro-science, because you're asking a higher quality of science to be performed in order to be convinced.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. It's not anti-science. And that's why it's so crazy, the kind of words people use, like anti-science or anti-vaccine. Those words don't even make sense. It's like, most people that are called anti-vaccine are actually the ones that want more science. Like, it's the parents that are calling to do the safety testing, and people are like, oh, no, we don't need to. They're just safe. It's like, well, if you look at the research, you can very clearly, very quickly see that there are big gaping holes in the research. And so there is a great need to do the best kind of safety testing, which is vaccinated kids versus unvaccinated kids, following them forward to see what we get. Doing an epidemiologic study is great. You can get lots of great information from it, but ultimately it's very biased. And the research tends to be, someone who's pro-vaccine finds something pro-vaccine, someone who's anti-vaccine finds something who's anti-vax in terms of their conclusions. And then, you know, that's how it is. Or anyone that finds something against a vaccine in terms of its safety, it doesn't ever come out, or that person loses their career. So it's a very biased world of research. And ultimately, we're at a place where I think we just need to get the best kind of research that there is. And that's a prospective trial. And it's never been done. It's never been done once. So to say that vaccines don't cause autism or vaccines couldn't cause long-term issues, the correct answer is we don't know, because we never actually studied it appropriately. We haven't seen that it does officially, but we can't say anything. We actually need to do the research that's appropriate. And when you have hundreds of thousands of parents saying, my kid got a vaccine and had a really bad reaction, and the next day they were very different, or I blame this on whatever happened with my kid, that should be enough for us to say, look, there are a lot of parents that think this, we should study it. They could be wrong, but if we want to give people confidence to do more vaccines, we should listen to these people instead of dismissing them.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of those studies which needs to be done more, and I think a lot of people agree, which is the idea that, you know, these kids or babies are literally getting multiple doses and multiple vaccines at once or in a very short period of time. And so even the sort of low quality individual studies that are done, like, and then, you know, we're stacking vaccine on top of vaccine and putting them all in the same vial. And you know, that then leads to the parents who are saying, like, it was this day that this happened. You know, we had 4 vaccines or 5 vaccines, or, you know, after the first year, we'd had 50 of them or whatever it is now. The number gets so high. But that idea that you can have multiple medicines and the risk we don't even consider that the risk could be multiple times?
Right. Well, that again goes back to just common basic sense, right? Everything that we look at basically in medicine, it's like a dose. Like the more of it that you have, the more risk there is. You know, you drink a little bit of lead, it's not good for you, but you'll probably be okay. You drink a lot of lead, you're going to die, right? Like we know these things. So I don't see why with a vaccine that mentality isn't similar. Like maybe one is okay. Maybe two is okay. Maybe four is not okay for everybody. Maybe 10 is less okay for more people. Like we have to be able to ask that question, because if we don't, then we're going to have one vaccine vial with 300 things in it. And we're never going to study if that's okay. And then every kid's just going to have a problem after they get it. Like that can't be what we do when we're moving forward in science. We have to say, is there a point where it's too much? If we're doing more, is that not necessarily better? It's not just better to do more. Like that's not always the case. It may be okay to do 5 or 6. Maybe what we're doing is totally fine and people are worried about nothing. But it's not unreasonable to say, well, we're doing 6 vaccines on one day. Is that too many? Well, what about if we did 8? What about if we did 10? Would we have fewer side effects if we did 4 instead of 6? Like, not every study has to be about not doing vaccines, but maybe you do a study between 6 vaccines on one day and 2, and you're like, whoa, with two vaccines, you have way fewer side effects. It doesn't mean you don't want people to get vaccines, but you want them to do it the safest possible. But right now, it's just do more. It's always do more. It's fine. The combination doesn't matter. Whichever one you want to do. Oh, you want to do this one? You could do the other one. It doesn't really make any difference. Mix and match. It's fine. And that is not how anything else is in the world.
Yeah, totally. And it's probably goes back to the 1986 scenario where these companies got legal immunity. And I feel like, they've had legal immunity through different periods of history. And I would encourage anybody that's, open to this, listening to this world or information or exploring it, to look into literally the 1700s, 1800s. Like so much went on then. But I'm curious as well with everything we're talking about, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, but like, where are you at with the autism conversation? Because I know that's huge in the media right now about what's causing autism and vaccines and aluminium and the other ingredients in there. Where are you at with your perspectives on that?
Yeah, I think that, the first part that I think is an issue with that conversation in general is that there isn't an acknowledgement that it's happening more. A lot of people still say, oh, we're just better at diagnosing it. I think that's insane. I think, look, we're certainly better at diagnosing it. I think that's certainly part of it. There's no question about it. We're talking about it a lot more. People are more interested in it. So there certainly is a much more diagnosis. I think that's true, but it's just happening way more. You look around and it's very obvious to anybody who takes care of kids or works with kids. In California, it's 1 in 12.5 boys now have autism. You don't look around in adults and see 1 in 15 adults with autism. Like that's just a stupid thing to say. Like it's not true. Like it's happening a lot more. So the question is why? And we don't know why. I think we know some of the things, but I don't think we have a very good understanding of it. And when it comes to vaccines, I think the answer is we don't know. I think that people have concerns around it, but if you look at the research, it hasn't really been studied appropriately. The research is heavily based upon MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, and thimerosal, the ingredient with mercury, which is not even in the vaccines anymore. So it's really just about MMR and not all the rest of the vaccines. So it's impossible to know. You have to study those things. You have to study vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids. You have to study all the vaccines. You have to look at the patterns to see if you notice an increased risk. There are some studies, not the best studies, that show maybe some association. There are other studies that don't show it. But really, you haven't studied vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids in any of those studies. So you don't know. And when you say something so definitive, like, oh, it's been debunked, we know that vaccines don't cause autism, that's insane. You look at the research and I'm not like all for vaccines cause autism, but I think that like you look at the research and it's so clearly obvious that you can't say it's debunked or that the science is set or that the science is so strong. We barely haven't done it at all. And the right research hasn't been done at all yet to answer this question. And that's either deliberate because people know and they don't want to do it, or for whatever reason, there's just been a pushback, or people are just so sure that it isn't causing it, they don't do the research. I don't know. But you don't even have massive database studies, which exist, that you could just, as a statistician, run any day to look at vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids for 20 years. Like you don't even have those studies. So it's really pretty insane that we say that we know when we just don't. We need to do those research and those studies.
Yeah, totally agree. As you said that being in denial of it happening, it made me think of like a similar cancer example of saying like, oh, we're just better at diagnosing cancer. Numbers haven't gone up. And it's like, oh my God, they've catastrophically gone up. It's so obvious, you know?
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's actually in the field knows that it's obvious. There are certainly individuals in the autism community where maybe they weren't diagnosed as a kid. So then they're like, I don't know, I think like sensitive to it. And they're like, well, I wasn't diagnosed as a kid and that's just why. But I'm like, no, what's going on? I think there's a lot more diagnosis of more mild autism, or more mild on the spectrum. But I think when you're talking about severe autism, the kids that have severe symptoms, that have a lot of trouble with their daily functions, that have severe communication issues, and that is so much higher than it ever was. That was a very small percentage, 50 years ago, very few kids. And now it's a lot. It's like 25-30%. And society is just not going to be able to manage that. Like most of those kids just don't ever function on their own, don't leave their home, don't get a job. And there's not a system set up for that many kids in 20 years from now to be fully dependent on a system. We have to figure out, for the kids where it is some sort of environmental trigger, what is it? Is it what we're doing? Is it what we're eating? Is it something to do with vaccines? Is it something to do with a toxin in our, whatever? I don't know what the answer is, but we need to start figuring this out. Because just to say it's just genetic, it doesn't work for me. I think genetics are certainly a part of it. There's no question we're finding genetic markers, but I think it's more than one thing. I think genetics plays a part, and then our environment kind of pushes you over the edge. And some people are probably more susceptible to it with their genetics, but I think it's not just genetics. It's a mixture of those things, but there's something or many things that are pushing kids over the edge into the diagnosis of autism, especially severe autism.
Yeah, I agree. And sort of not negating everything you've just said in regards to the physicality and the biology, but I would also say socially, two things. One, we seem to have the victim Olympics these days, and people can't wait to get their label to justify who they are. And the second thing is natural variation in psychological, you know, identity and behavior and expression. And I think, you know, we're also trying to squish more people into this, I don't know, like carbon copy of one another as well. And once upon a time, somebody who was a little bit weird or a little bit strange had just amazing skills in a different area, you know? Whereas I think we're socially a little bit sort of, the second that somebody isn't perfectly conforming to the way that society functions, it's like, oh, quick, give them a medical label.
Yeah, and that's what I said. I think we're much quicker to give a label. We like to label everything now. We want to label our viruses, our COVID, our RSV. We want to label our, you know, idiosyncrasies. And that's fine. I mean, you know, getting a label, having a diagnosis of autism, it may be helpful and supportive, especially, you know, for individuals who need that kind of support. That's great. And I think that is the part of autism that has been underdiagnosed for generations and probably is a lot more diagnosed now. But I think that for a lot of those, especially the adults, those are fully functioning adults. They're not the kind of autism that generally people are talking about. The kids are having severe issues. The families are having severe issues. It's like that's not the same thing. I mean, and it's the same diagnosis, but it's such a wide spectrum, and there are individuals with autism that are like have super skills, and they're like brilliant and super well functioning. So I think like most people are not talking about those kids. You know, they're talking about the other end. And I think if you're fully happy and don't need support, great, like that's wonderful. But there are a lot of kids that do. And I think that for most health practitioners, that's the group that we're talking about, is the ones that need full support and the families that need full support, and the ones that say, you know, my kid was 2 years old and acting totally normally, you know, air quotes normally, and reading and smiling and laughing and running, and they went into the doctor and got this thing, or, you know, they were normal this day and the next day they weren't, and they couldn't read anymore, and they didn't have eye contact and they couldn't communicate. Those are the kids that we need to figure out what's going on. And if a vaccine did it to them or some other environmental trigger or whatever it is, like, that's what we have to figure out. It's not to shame anybody for their brain type or the way that they think, but it's the kids that are injured from a thing that we're doing in our environment. If that's happening, we should be figuring it out. And there are hundreds of thousands, millions of parents that do feel that. So I think they deserve to be heard, and they deserve for that to be researched as much as possible, because ultimately we should try to figure that out so we can change that moving forward. If there's some part of autism or any condition, whatever, cancer, you know, do we want to say, oh, it's just cancer is a spectrum? No, we want to prevent it if we can. If you can prevent your colon cancer, if you can figure out what might cause it, of course we want to prevent it, right? If you want to prevent a serious brain inflammation from somebody, yes, of course we want to prevent that, right? For those kids that we can. for those kids that, that it's possible to be done, if it's possible to be done.
Yeah, I agree. I guess anybody listening, whether they're adults, whether they've got children, what are the questions or communication tools that you would like people to be equipped with when they go into the doctor's office?
I think the first thing is just to be aware that it's okay to ask questions. I think that we've moved into a place where it's almost not okay to ask questions of your doctor anymore. A lot of people are just dismissing patients if they ask questions about vaccines, and they're thinking they're woo-woo or, you know, out there. Like, we can't do that. You have to be comfortable, especially if you are holistic-minded or want to do anything outside of the regular schedule. You have to be okay asking those questions, and you should try to ask them early if you can. Like, if you're, you know, interviewing practices, try to see, you know, ask questions of those doctors. See if they're open to you doing a slower schedule. See if they're open to doing something else. Ask them questions about vaccines. Like, you have to be okay doing that, because I think the more the people are asking these questions, the more that doctors can be able to force to answer them, and then the more that the conversation is going to be had. And ultimately, that's going to lead to a much better place where we can find some sort of middle ground, because ultimately, everybody wants healthy kids. Not everybody agrees on how to get there. But we have to have these conversations, and we need doctors to stop digging their heels in so much and to start listening a little bit and hearing the concerns that parents have, and then acknowledging the gaps in the research, and then saying, well, here's what we know. I believe in vaccines. I think you should do it, but ultimately, you know, you should choose what's right for you. I think we'd be in a much better place if we can kind of move more back to education and less to forcing people to do stuff.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I think as well with the doctors digging their heels in, we've got a bit of a hangover maybe of the days where doctors were like the most superior beings to walk the earth, socially speaking. And it's like, the doctor's super intelligent. They know everything. Don't question them. They're a doctor, you know. And even now, when you say somebody's a doctor, people are like, oh, okay. Like, you know, that's pretty legit. And so I'm hoping that is starting to break a little bit, so that we can just be two humans in an office having a conversation.
Yeah, I think it's breaking because of the internet, because people can look stuff up now. So, you know, even if you don't know what you're talking about, you can still Google it and you can still get some pretty good information. And obviously, that's not the same thing as going to med school, but the access to information is there where it wasn't before. Like, you know, before, if you wanted to figure out what was going on, you'd have to like go to the library, look it up, figure out what you should look up, read about it. Like, people weren't doing that. But now you can be like, all right, here's a picture of my rash. What is this? You know, ChatGPT. Yeah. And it could give you six answers, right? And so the information is a little more available for you to be able to have a conversation with a practitioner and put you more on their level. And ultimately, the technology is getting so good that sometimes the technology is right and the doctor is wrong. And so it's like, it's really hard, because there's so much information out there, and you sit there as a doctor and you're like, well, you know, obviously if you're humble, you don't know everything. But you realize that these technologies can look at the stuff faster, can think about more things, think about things you never even heard of. And so it does, I think, put you on a little bit more even playing field, where I think if the profession doesn't get a little bit more humble, it's going to get replaced. And so I think that ultimately right now there's still this pushback of like, I know better. Doesn't matter what you say. Doesn't matter what the internet says. These people are all anti-vaxxers and they're crazy, and they're not listening to the concerns. And then you're getting more pushback. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, there were the highest rates of unvaccinated kids, the highest rates of exemptions, the highest rates of people that are hesitant. Yeah, it's like 50% plus now are saying they don't trust the government. They don't trust the regular schedule. They're not sure they're going to do the regular schedule. Like, that's very high compared to what it used to be.
Yeah. For people listening that's like, Joel's awesome, I want to get more of him in my life, where can they find you online?
So the best places would be at Dr. Joel Gator on Instagram or X. And the book, Between a Shot and a Hard Place, you can get on Amazon or theshotbook.com.
Yeah, fantastic. I'll put those links down in the show notes below. So if you're listening and you want more of this information and you want to inform yourself or just be willing to have more difficult conversations, hopefully we have enough of those difficult conversations that they stop becoming difficult, then scroll down, click the link and jump into Joel's work. So before we finish, we're going to do our little real talk segment. We're going to go back and forth pretty quickly and get to know Joel a bit better. So are you cool with that, Joel?
Cool with it.
Amazing. All right. So question one, what's something that you believe now that made you laugh 10 years ago?
Something that I believe now? I mean, I think I would have laughed 10 years ago about just like the healthy woo-woo world. You know, like all the natural stuff. I have a very normal life, kind of like what it sounds like for you. And now, you know, almost anything that's in that woo-woo world, I'm like a little bit more open to it, even if I don't like necessarily believe in it, like, I don't know, energy medicine or something like that. I'm like, well, you know, we are kind of all energy, so maybe there's something to it.
What's one habit that you'd be embarrassed to admit that you still have?
One habit, for me, I think it's just watching too much TV sometimes. So like, and I really try to not to limit my screen time, but sometimes it's like so crazy in life that just watching screens sometimes too much, I have to be like, got to get off my phone.
What's one supplement, habit, or wellness trend that you think is totally overhyped?
Overhyped. I think that just supplements in general, in terms of like one size fits all. I think I see that so much in my practice, is, you know, kind of giving everybody the same long list of supplements or giving everybody the same kind of medicines. Like, I think we need individualized medicine. So I think just doing things the same for everybody is way overhyped.
This is going to be an interesting question. What's a rabbit hole topic that you think more people should explore?
Well, we talked about vaccines, so I think that. But I mean, if we're not going to say vaccines, then I think one of the weirdest rabbit hole conversations that I never thought was a rabbit hole was circumcision. I learned that throughout my days as a pediatrician, that actually circumcision, there's a lot more people that are a lot angrier about it, that it's quite the rabbit hole that you wouldn't even think was.
Fascinating. In 20 years from now, what do you want to be known for?
I would hope to be known for in 20 years just being an advocate for kids and being a part of policy change and trying to help push forward, you know, a better, healthier future for my kids and everyone's than where we are today.
And finally, if everything you've ever said was deleted, what's one sentence that you want to leave people with?
I would say, you know, it's not woo-woo for asking questions. I think we're all in this together and we have to take our health back into our own hands, and we can do that.
Fantastic. Joel, thanks for being on the show, man.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too, that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.